Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 25th of November, these are our main stories. 24 hostages released by Hamas in Gaza are now back in Israel and are in the process of being reunited with their families. The UN says 137 trucks delivered aid to Gaza on Friday, by far the greatest daily number since the conflict began. A fishing vessel has been seized by suspected Somali pirates, a practice thought to have been virtually stamped out a decade ago. Also in this podcast...
Do you just want to step out for me for a second?
Okay, it'll just be a second. We'll just go up here so we're out of the way.
How what appeared to be a routine traffic stop turned into a marriage proposal. And we hear how English football referees are turning to aviation to communicate more effectively. It's the moment that Israelis had been praying and longing for in the past 7 weeks. Hamas's release of the first group of hostages.
Welcome to I-24 News. I'm Albert Lewitton at the I-24 News Desk in Tel Aviv. You're looking at live coverage of the release of 13 hostages, Israeli hostages.
Israeli television showed images of the 24 hostages, 13 Israelis, 10 Thais and one Filipino, being transported in a convoy of Red Cross vehicles through the Rafah crossing into Egypt. They're now back in Israel as part of a deal in which fighting has been paused for 4 days. Palestinian prisoners released and aid allowed into Gaza after weeks of Israeli bombardment and siege. This followed the massacre of October the 7th when 1,200 people were killed by Hamas in Israel. More than 200 other hostages still remain in Gaza, among them Gil Dickman's relatives. But for him, this was a much-needed sign of hope.
I can't believe it's finally here. I haven't seen the pictures yet, but I know family members of the kids who are coming back home now. I feel as if part of my family came back. Behind us, there's a guy. He's taking off the names of the kidnapped from the signs that are signed right here. I can't believe they're finally here.
Our Jerusalem correspondent, Tom Bateman, told us more about the release of the hostages whose ages range from 2 years old to 85.
There's been a couple of moments where we've caught a glimpse of them. First of all, when the Red Cross jeeps were passing through the Rafah crossing, and we could see clearly at least one child in the back of one of the jeeps, an elderly woman who waved as the jeeps passed some of the cameras there. There was then another moment where they appeared to be close to an Egyptian medical facility or an Egyptian facility, where several of them were seen walking into that area, and they looked, the ones we saw, they looked pretty well. But what's happening now is that they've been taken after having crossed onto the Israeli side by the Israeli military, taken to an airbase in the south of the country where they're going to have preliminary checks. They can make phone calls then to the family members, and they'll then be taken to a few different hospitals in Israel. And that's when they'll be reunited with their families. They'll have those proper medical checks at that point. So expect over the next kind of 12 hours or so, we'll hear a fair bit more about the condition there.
Yeah, so some of them will be reunited with their families, but we're hearing that some of them don't know that family members have died.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the case, because obviously communications have been extremely difficult, we know, throughout all of this. And yes, that sense that many of them don't know about what's happened to relatives. Remember the absolute chaos, the brutality in which this whole thing was sparked in October the 7th. We also saw those images of the way people were being held captive and the way they were brought into the Gaza Strip. And also you have families, entire families, that are now effectively separated. Among the 13 released are three generations of one family, an elderly woman and then a mother and young daughter. Now the grandmother in that family is among those released. Her husband is still being held captive in Gaza. So these have been sort of extraordinarily difficult moments. And I expect we'll hear more stories like that as we hear more the returnees that decide to speak out. We don't know if any of them will or which ones will. I expect we'll hear more of that kind of thing.
And over the next 3 days, we're expecting to see more hostages released, 50 in all. But there are hopes that perhaps that number could increase further.
Yeah, so 50 is over the course of this, what was agreed to be a four-day ceasefire. But there is in the agreement what's been termed an option to extend for a further 5 days. And you would see in that period anywhere between 10, 11, 12, up to 13 hostages released again per day. And in return, for each hostage that is released, three Palestinian prisoners would be freed by Israel. Now, my understanding of this is that it would be a maximum of 5 days because the entire scope of this agreement is around civilian women and children. And it's thought that there are around 100 in that category held captive by Hamas in Gaza. So after that point, that takes you to around 100 people. I mean, if they got to a point where 100 civilian women and children were freed, you would then be into other categories of captives that would include soldiers and also the men being held. Now, they are not part of the scope of this agreement, and that's why it's always been termed as a maximum sort of 9 days. And after that, you've got both sides saying the war will go on.
Tom Bateman. Well, as we've heard, part of the deal was for 39 Palestinian prisoners to be released from jails in Israel and the occupied West Bank in exchange for the hostages being freed from Gaza. 24 women and 15 teenage boys, most of whom were being held in pre-trial detention, were released. Onlookers cheered as buses left Offa prison in the West Bank. Noor Odeh is a Palestinian political analyst and activist. She told the BBC more about the Palestinians who've been released from this prison.
They are women and children, many of whom have been detained without any charge. At least five of the children are what Israel calls administrative detainees. These are kids who are held without charge or trial. Some of the women were serving sentences, but to explain to the audience, Palestinians, including children, are subjected to military courts. So these are not ordinary courts that you would think of in London or any other Western capital. These are military courts that don't adhere to the same due process standards. And that's why in the eyes of the Palestinian public, these are not convicted people, they weren't rightly convicted, and many really view them as well as hostages. Their release, even though it's just 39 out of thousands, is very welcome news for Palestinians.
Palestinian activist Noor Odeh. Well, our correspondent in the West Bank city of Ramallah, Lucy Williamson, watched as Palestinians there celebrated the release.
Behind me, the green flags of Hamas. There are many people here who credit Hamas with securing this release, saying we'd like it to have happened without the hostages taken by Hamas, but without those hostages, Israel would never have released these prisoners. To Israel, the people being released here tonight have been arrested, have been charged on security grounds, but to the people here, they're the victims of Israel's occupation. There's just been more tear gas fired by the Israeli forces towards the crowd here. They were really crowded around the Red Cross car, demanding to know where the Palestinian prisoners were. There's a rising sense of frustration that's been building here for hours now, and it's at the point of boiling over.
Lucy Williamson in Ramallah. Meanwhile, the biggest humanitarian convoy to enter Gaza since the conflict began passed through the Rafah crossing with Egypt. The UN says 137 trucks carried urgently needed food, water, medicines and fuel into Gaza on Friday. Similar quantities of aid are scheduled to follow over the next 3 days of the truce. More than 1.5 million people have been made homeless in Gaza, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. It also said that around 15,000 people have been killed, a third of them children. The UN said it would be callous to go from a pause to killing children again. Bushra Khalidi from the aid charity Oxfam agreed that the pause in the fighting needs to be longer than 4 or 5 days.
that's not enough. Trucks should be coming in and out of Gaza at all times. And without a permanent ceasefire, we can't really deliver this amount of aid in 4 days. How are we supposed to build homes and rebuild hospitals and allow women to have a safe place to deliver their babies? And where is the restoration of electricity and water, which are absolutely essential to meeting the needs of 2.2 million people, 2 million of which have been displaced and are practically destitute? People are starving. People are dehydrated. Women are dying giving birth. Babies are dying while being born. There is a 25 to 30% increase in premature babies being born in Gaza. Shelters remain overcrowded and also indiscriminately targeted. The situation has not essentially changed. So, you know, the trucks and the fuel is welcome. The pause is really about not having bombardments over their heads and allowing Gazans to sleep for at least a night properly. And I really hope they get a good night's sleep in the next 4 days, because Israel has been very clear that it plans to continue its military operations in the south and has been clear about potentially intensifying its military operations. So I do hope that they're able to rest and brace themselves for what's coming next week.
Bushra Khalidi from Oxfam. Demonstrations are expected across Italy this weekend after an Italian student was found murdered. The body of Giulia Cecchettin, who was 22, was discovered near a lake in northeastern Italy a week after she went missing. Italian politicians have backed new measures to tackle violence against women in a rare show of cross-party unity. More details from our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
Women on the streets of Milan demanding that their voices are heard. The banners they carried made clear the source of their anger. Freedom from violence, demanded one. We want to live. It's the murder of 22-year-old Giulia Cecchettin that's prompted a wave of protests across Italy. The medical engineering student disappeared after going with her boyfriend to buy a graduation outfit. CCTV footage then emerged, which apparently showed him beating her in a car park, and her body was later found wrapped in plastic bags. He was arrested in Germany and faces being extradited. But the killing has prompted claims that patriarchal attitudes remain all too common in Italy, with abuse and violence against women an inevitable consequence.
Paul Moss. Somali piracy was once a huge problem on the high seas, but then it was almost completely eradicated in an impressive example of international cooperation by the world's navies and shipping owners. Now, though, it seems the threat may be rearing its head again. Suspected Somali pirates have captured a Yemeni fishing vessel and its mostly Iranian crew. I heard more from our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
Well, according to one of the co-owners of this fishing vessel, which is called the Al Mirage One, it was taken by pirates who came from a small port town in Somalia called Ail. That is a place that was very notorious back in the day, sort of 2008 to 2011, when the piracy was really rife. That's where a lot of the pirate gangs came from. But according to this co-owner, there are some 16 Iranian fishermen and a Somali national on board. And he says the gang holding them are asking for a $400,000 ransom. And they've threatened to carry out other piracy attacks in the area off the Somali coast unless that ransom is paid. But we haven't had anything official from the Somali authorities or from any of the international organisations that help with the patrolling of that water.
And as you said, this was once a very common problem, Somali piracy, but it had almost completely stopped. So this is a rare case now.
Yeah, it is a fairly rare case. After the 2008, when the problem got really bad, there was a lot of work done to try and make the ships safer. So in terms of setting up sort of safe rooms inside the ships where people could lock themselves and not be held hostage. But the main thing was the deployment of international warships. And there's still an international presence there now. The European Union has a naval operation off the Somali coast. And it's just been given a mandate to go through till the end of next year, because there had been some suggestion that perhaps they would pack up and leave because there were so few attacks.
Will Ross. Now to the US, where what looked like a routine traffic stop by police officers in the state of Wisconsin turned out to be something completely different. Stephanie Tillotson takes up the story.
Troy Goldschmidt and his girlfriend Mariah Pritchard were on a short holiday in Eau Claire in Wisconsin. They were driving down a quiet but windy street close to the river downtown when this happened.
Do you just want to step out for me for a second?
Okay, it'll just be a second. We'll just go up here so we're out of the way. You all set?
So Troy did what he was told. Then Mariah was approached.
Hi. Hi, I'm Officer Anderson. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. Would you mind just stepping out with me as well?
Yeah, oh, sure.
Okay. So, like you said, it's just kind of not a big deal. We just have to make sure that his license comes back.
Okay.
So, got to make sure that there's
a law-abiding citizen, Mariah, also did what she was told, expecting the police were carrying out a routine traffic stop, only to turn round and see Troy down on one knee.
I love you so much. You're my best friend. I want to spend the rest of my life with you.
Eau Claire Police Department helped Mr. Goldschmidt arrange his proposal. They said you never know what's going to happen on a traffic stop.
Stephanie Tillotson reporting on an unusual police engagement. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
During series like Black Friday, we tend to buy more stuff that we do not use and that we will throw away.
Why the French government has been urging people not to spend money on Black Friday.
Food is incredibly important in the world.
It's about survival,
culinary heritage,
culture and tradition,
different relationships across the world.
The Food Chain from the BBC World Service examines the business, science and cultural significance of food.
If this kind of food is lost, a community will lose its identity.
And what it takes to put food on your plate.
This is an incredible journey.
Search for The Food Chain wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News podcast. King Charles is already among the wealthiest people in Britain, but it's emerged the monarch has collected tens of millions of pounds from people who have died in the northwest of England. This is because of a centuries-old scheme, which means the assets of people without a will or no next of kin goes to the king through his hereditary estate, the Duchy of Lancaster. A similar scheme operates in Cornwall in southwest England through his son Prince William's estate. Norman Baker is a former Member of Parliament who wrote a book about how the royal family spends public money. My colleague, Nick Eardley, has been speaking to him about the story reported by The Guardian newspaper here in the UK.
This scheme has been going for centuries. It's a feudal scheme that really should have been abolished centuries ago. What happens is if somebody dies without a will in the Duchy of Lancaster, then that money or their estate goes to King Charles. And similarly, if someone dies without a will in the Duchy of Cornwall area, then their estate goes to the Prince of Wales. This is an extraordinary feudal arrangement that should have been dealt with centuries ago.
And we're talking about quite a lot of money here, aren't we? Tens of millions of pounds.
Well, indeed. We're talking about a huge geographical area. And also, it doesn't just include individuals. It can include businesses that go bankrupt.
Now, the reason The Guardian are reporting on this today is because they've seen documents suggesting that that money's not all going to charity, that some of it is going to renovate property, which is then rented out for a profit. Is the problem the principle of the whole thing, or is it how the money's being used?
Well, the principle itself is absurd and should have been dealt with centuries ago. But I mean, what we saw in World War II was that George VI was benefiting from soldiers dying who had been residents in the Duchy of Lancaster, and their money was going to him personally. After the Second World War, the royals then said that they would change arrangements, and the money which accrued through the Duchy of Lancaster's curious intestate arrangements would be used to give to charities. Well, you know, that's what we believed and I believed as a royal author was actually happening.
The Duchy of Lancaster have responded to this story and said that the money King Charles has agreed should be used primarily to support local communities, protect the sustainability and biodiversity of the land, and preserve public and historic properties across the Duchy of Lancaster estates. They're essentially arguing that this is about keeping important buildings for future generations.
Yeah, King Charles's buildings, which will increase the value of those buildings and the rental value that can be derived from them, going straight into King Charles's own properties and his own assets.
So what's your view on what should happen now? How should this be reformed or just scrapped completely?
Of course it should be scrapped. It's got no place in the 21st century, this sort of ludicrous feudal arrangement. The royal family over the years has been very, very keen to minimise what they spend personally and to maximise the amount of money they get from the public purse. 7.9 million was the civil list allocation in 2011. Last year, the sovereign grant, its replacement, gave them 86.3 million, a huge increase. They continue to be exempt from inheritance tax. The Duchy of Lancaster and Duchy of Cornwall pay no corporation tax or capital gains tax, although they class themselves as private estates. Everywhere you look, they are seeking to gain money from the public purse. And Parliament, through the Public Accounts Committee, should instigate a proper and thorough investigation of royal finances and royal wealth.
Norman Baker speaking to the BBC. And the Duchy of Lancaster said that on accession to the throne, His Majesty the King reaffirmed that money should not benefit the sovereign's private income, but should be used primarily to support local communities, protect land and preserve public and historic buildings. A South Korean fan of true crime has been sentenced to life in prison after she murdered a stranger and told police she did it out of curiosity. Jung Yoo Jung was said to be obsessed with crime shows and novels and scored highly on psychopath tests, according to police. Our Asia Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, told us more.
This is a crime carried out by a young woman, 23 years old, called Jung Yoo Jung, and she carried it out in May. What she did was she stabbed dozens of times a teacher who she'd contacted on an app. Essentially what she'd done is she's posed as a mother looking for a tutor, an English tutor for her daughter, contacted the victim, and then when they'd agreed a time for this supposed daughter to go around, it was the killer who turned up, went into the house and then carried out a killing. It really is. It's a crime which carried out earlier this year, really shocked South Korea.
And she apparently did it just because she was curious, because she was a fan of true crime and wanted to see what it was like to be a criminal herself.
Exactly. That's why it's really been such a crime which has captured the imagination in South Korea. As you said, she did become obsessed with true crimes, books, TVs, and simply carried out this murder out of curiosity. Of course, there's a little bit more to the backstory. The murderer herself had been a loner for much of her life. Initially, she actually denied she'd carried out the murder, but there was a lot of evidence to point to the fact that she'd done it, CCTV evidence. She'd actually gone back home after carrying out the killing, got a suitcase and taken it back to her victim's house, cut up the body and then disposed of it. She was caught because the taxi driver who drove her saw some sort of something suspicious and called the police.
So for a fan of true crime, she seems to have been very careless, and she was also trying to plead for a more lenient sentence.
Yes, the first point you mentioned there about being careless, the police noticed that. They believe that she just, because she was so obsessed with carrying out this crime, she hadn't really thought it through properly. She just carried out the crime and hadn't really worked out what she was going to do afterwards. And so she left lots of evidence, including keeping her victim's identity card. Some body parts were found at her own house. She'd actually got a lot of blood on her when she carried out this murder, so I had to change into the victim's clothes. So really, she hadn't thought this through and was caught. She finally admitted quite recently that she'd carried out the murder and apologised a few days ago.
Mickey Bristow. The French government is urging shoppers to think twice before they spend money on the Black Friday weekend. It wants customers to consider the environmental impact of what they're buying as well as their own finances. From Paris, our correspondent Hugh Schofield sent this report.
In a clothes shop, a customer is choosing between two cut-price polo shirts. Which is better, he asks an assistant. But the assistant has a badge saying he's a dévendeur, a D-seller. And what he says is, don't buy either. The one you're wearing is perfectly fine. If you don't spend, you help your pocket and the planet. The ads have been put out to coincide with so-called Black Friday, an institution which in just a few years has become a fixture here in France as elsewhere. But if one part of President Macron's government, the green bit, clearly frowns on the model of mass throwaway consumerism, another bit, the economic bit, feels differently. This was the economy minister, Bruno Le Maire, calling the ads ill-conceived because of the harm they would do to honest retailers. On the Champs-Élysées today, most shoppers said the government was right to urge people to think twice before making a purchase.
I think that especially in those times, this is a good thing.
Kind of make me realize that during sales like Black Friday, we tend to buy more stuff that we do not use and that we will throw away.
In other initiatives, the French government also recently launched a repair bonus, under which you can get a small subsidy every time you get clothes mended by a registered tailor. Little gestures, like the ads, meant to nudge people towards new behaviour.
Hugh Schofield. Referees are never short of advice. It often takes the form of verbal abuse from the stands, but now they're taking tips from a far more genteel group of individuals. British Airways pilots have been drafted in to teach the Premier League's top officials how to communicate clearly when reviewing decisions using video technology known as VAR. Our sports correspondent, Andy Swiss, takes up the story.
It's my great pleasure to be flying over to Washington today.
The voice of a British Airways pilot. Clear, calm, in control.
So taking off towards the west, we climb up to our initial cruising level of 36,000 feet.
Now contrast that with this.
Are you happy with this?
Off-field go, yeah. That's what it does.
What?
A chaotic chat between the video officials during Spurs' game against Liverpool, which ended with a goal being wrongly ruled out.
Yes, onside. The image we get is onside.
Left back. He's played. He's gone offside.
So to improve their communication skills, England's top referees sought the advice of two BA pilots about their language and about how to deal with multiple voices in stressful situations. While VAR officials have at times adopted an informal tone, the pilots spoke to them about the need for simplicity and clarity to avoid potential confusion. It's not the first time referees have received guidance from the aviation industry. Last year, they had a presentation from air traffic control staff. So while VAR's had a bumpy takeoff so far in England, it'll be hoping for less turbulent times ahead.
Andy Swiss. We return now to our top story, the release of 24 hostages who've been held by Hamas in Gaza for nearly 7 weeks and the subsequent freeing of 39 Palestinian women and teenagers from jails in Israel and the occupied West Bank. However, more than 200 hostages remain in Gaza, although dozens more are expected to be released in the coming days. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, has been speaking to members of one family who are unlikely to be reunited soon.
In the shade of an olive tree in the heart of Tel Aviv, in what has become known as Hostage Plaza, a group of women sit in a circle, singing and remembering. They are friends and relatives of 38-year-old Itai Svirsky, taken by Hamas from a kibbutz near the Gaza border. They know he won't be home soon. For Itai's cousin, Naama Weinberg, there are mixed emotions today.
When I will see those hostages back here in Israel, I will be very happy for their families and for them.
It's
12 or 13 hostages that will be released today, hopefully, and 50 total in the next 4 days is less than a quarter. We can't think that it's ended by this. It must be only the beginning.
She and other relatives we have spoken to are worried that their loved ones are in danger while they remain in Gaza. We know that every day might be the last one, Naama says, and that's a very hard thought.
In our hearts hasn't stopped.
Many Israelis feel connected to the hostages. Their faces have been everywhere for the past 6 weeks.
Just come home.
So there is a sense of collective relief that some are coming home.
Orla Guerin reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adley and it was mixed by Nick Randall. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.